You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Western Wisconsin's rural counties helped President Trump win office in 2016. We'll check in on how farmers are feeling after 4 years of the Trump administration and whether their support is still strong enough to help him win the state again. Now, former Vice President Joe Biden is officially the Democratic nominee for president after the roll call vote at the virtual party convention last night. Democratic leaders have been working to unify the party since primary season and invited progressives, moderates, and even some Republicans to speak at this week's convention. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said last night that unity is key for the party to win back the White House and control of Congress.
Democrats must take back the Senate. We will stay united from Sanders and Warren to Manchin and Warner. And with our unity, we will bring bold and dramatic change to our country.
Some Wisconsin leaders, like Congressional Representative Gwen Moore and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, have spoken so far during the convention. Governor Tony Evers scheduled to speak tonight. But it is a far cry from the event that was once expected to bring more than 50,000 people to Milwaukee. David Cannon is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Madison. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, at one point early in the primary campaign, David, people were talking about a contested convention. That's not happening. What do you think of this focus from so many on unity in the Democratic Party?
Well, it seems to be a pretty effective message right now that they are doing two different things to try to achieve that party unity. One, you alluded to, of inviting a broad range of speakers from, you know, Bernie Sanders on the left, who gave a much stronger appeal, I think, for unity this time around than he did 4 years ago. To those more in the center, and even, as you mentioned, on the Republican side. And I thought two of the more effective appeals along those lines were from John Kasich, the former, you know, Republican governor of Ohio and candidate for the presidency himself, and then Cindy McCain, who talked about the long friendship of John McCain and Joe Biden. And this is a fairly direct appeal to people who, you know, want politicians who are willing to work with each other, not always, you know, be locked in such partisan battle the way it seems we are today. And so I thought both the Kasich and McCain overtures were pretty effective. And then to have Sanders, you know, making that very strong appeal to the progressive base of the party to say, you know, this is really a lot at stake here, which brings me to the second point then that is also, I think, at the core of this appeal for party unity, and that is keeping focus on Donald Trump and how there's so much at stake here. You heard, you know, so many speakers say that this is the most important election of your life. A very effective speech two nights ago from Michelle Obama saying just explicitly, you know, vote like your life depends on it was her most memorable line, I think, from that speech. And so focusing on the fact that, you know, the party really needs to defeat Donald Trump, and as Chuck Schumer said in the clip you had, you know, needs to retake control of the Senate. It's that focus, I think, that's bringing the party together of what can, you know, span a pretty big ideological spread in the Democratic Party, really is being pulled together, I think, by that focus on defeating Donald Trump.
I want to talk about two different types of voters, maybe real, maybe hypothetical in one case. First, Democrats concerned that there were Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 who voted for somebody other than Hillary Clinton, either for Donald Trump or a third party candidate or for nobody. Are they worried about, are you expecting to see something like that happen again?
Well, I mean, I think that's always a concern for the Democratic Party. I think that because this argument that so much is at stake this time around, I think that's less of a concern this year than it was 4 years ago. And I think you saw that most explicitly in Bernie Sanders' speech, you know, because he had a fairly, you know, tepid endorsement of Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. And it was clear that he was, you know, kind of bruised by that campaign. And his supporters were more than bruised. They were pretty unhappy with the way that went. And so I think that there are a lot of Sanders supporters who did, as you say, either sit it out or perhaps voted for Jill Stein or somebody else. I think that's less likely to happen this time around because now Sanders and others on the left have made the case that there's a lot at stake now, and I think that's pretty clear to everyone.
And on the other hand, bringing in John Kasich, Cindy McCain, Colin Powell, and so on is appealing to I guess, a hypothetical group of voters, Republicans or former Republicans who don't like Donald Trump. We know that there are prominent thinkers here in Wisconsin, Charlie Sykes among them, who are making a lot of noise along those lines. Are there actual voters, though, who can be appealed to in a successful way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I feel sort of less confident saying there that, you know, that is a significant group of voters. I mean, you have the Lincoln Project that has these clever ads that have been really, you know, digging at Trump and, you know, trying to appeal to the never Trumpers. But in terms of actually appealing to, you know, Trump supporters who may be on the fence, some of those efforts, it's not clear they're paying off that much at this point. On the other hand, you know, Trump's numbers in terms of his approval ratings among Republicans are down a little bit, but still at you know, very strong levels historically.
Talking to David Cannon, professor and chair of political science at UW-Madison, looking at this week's Democratic National Convention, sort of in Milwaukee, a little bit of Wisconsin love, not what people expected originally. Want to give a listen to Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes talking during the roll call last night.
We know that we build a better future for our nation by channeling Wisconsin's legacy as the birthplace of the labor and the progressive movement and uniting around a bold, inclusive agenda that uplifts every community.
Part of the reason for picking Milwaukee, David, was that Wisconsin was a swing state that swung the other way last time. Is there enough Wisconsin love here going on to appeal to the state?
Well, yeah, it is too bad, certainly, for Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin, the way this has worked out, that, you know, we were going to have 50,000 people here for the convention. It would have been a huge boost to the local economy, certainly, and it would have, you know, allowed the party to, you know, showcase all of their arguments, you know, in a battleground state that's going to be critical for Joe Biden this time around. So clearly that's a loss for the Biden campaign, for the Democratic Party generally, and obviously for the city of Milwaukee itself. So it's unfortunate it worked out that way, but I think there really was no choice, and there's no way they could have had anything close to 50,000 people, you know, assembling in Milwaukee for the convention. So for public health reasons, they really had to make that call.
And we're seeing counter-programming. President Trump in Oshkosh this week, Vice President Pence in Darien today. I think Eric Trump was in the state this week. They are trying to make the case that they're going to come here in person and try to re-earn Wisconsin this time around.
Yeah, they absolutely are a presence in the state the way the Biden campaign really has not been doing any of these, you know, in-person rallies at this point. And it's not clear if they are going to change that approach at all moving forward. A lot of people criticized Hillary Clinton 4 years ago for not ever showing up in Wisconsin and kind of taking the state for granted. And indeed, every poll from Labor Day to Election Day, except for one, had her ahead in Wisconsin. So I think they thought they had Wisconsin locked up. And so obviously that didn't work out as planned. And so I'm sure there are going to be people in the Biden camp who, you know, don't want to repeat that mistake. On the other hand, it's not 2020 is not like 2016 in terms of these, you know, big, huge rallies. It's just not going to be happening this time around. It's just not safe to have 20,000 people in an arena or, you know, 40,000 people outside at a rally. It's just a different environment. So we'll see if Biden ends up doing any in-person campaigning at all in this election, or if it's going to be conducted more remotely this time around.
Of course, underlying all these decisions is COVID-19. Are you hearing Democrats make the case that, hey, we've got this disease that this year, just part of this year, has killed over, 170,000 people now? Are they making the case that this is under President Trump's watch?
Well, absolutely. And that's clearly the argument that they're making in terms of, you know, they're the more responsible party here in terms of how, you know, state governors have been responding to this. And the failure of the United States compared to most other Western countries, you know, we have not fared as well as most countries in terms of our response. And so they are trying anyway to lay this at the feet of President Trump.
David, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Okay, very good. Talk to you later.
David Cannon is a professor and chair of political science at UW-Madison. He was with us for a check-in on the Democratic National Convention, which started on Monday, wraps up on Thursday. Coming up, we'll learn about a new project that's providing grants to artists impacted by COVID-19 in central Wisconsin. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the head of an arts organization about a new grant program that pays artists to paint murals in Portage County. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a new song called Milwaukee Strong.
The city of Milwaukee recently declared July 24th Milwaukee Strong Day, encouraging residents to remain united in the face of dual crises, the coronavirus pandemic and systemic racism. The centerpiece of the day was the song Milwaukee Strong, which features more than 30 local artists. Milwaukee musician Sean Hinton wrote and produced the track.
I'm the guitarist for Mary J. Blige. I've been playing with Mary since 2004. I've had the privilege of also working for Jill Scott, John Legend, Jay-Z, and Lil Wayne.
So how did Sean first hear about the project?
May 26th, a good friend of mine by the name of Kevin Suker texted me. He texted me like, need to talk to you. You got a minute?
My name is Kevin Suker, and I'm the executive director of 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. And the mayor's office called and said, got something we'd like to ask you. And the executive director of Imagine MKE, which is another amazing nonprofit in Milwaukee.
We have Louisville, Kentucky, and the mayor. They did a song called Lift Up Louisville, and they challenged us to do one. Lift
up Louisville. So I called Sean Hinton, who is an unbelievably talented guitar player and writer and producer.
This is kind of a big deal. Like, it's nothing like writing a song for yourself, but it's another thing to write something that could possibly represent who we are as Milwaukeeans. Now keep in mind, we're fresh off of the heels of the Miller Coors shooting that claimed the lives of 5 employees there, then the pandemic happening, and then we had to deal with the civil unrest with George Floyd dying. It was weighing heavy on my heart. I needed to do something. From the ashes and the dust. I cut the song here in my living room. Be Free cut a song with her and her husband's studio. I shot my video here at home, and everybody else, you know, they did their exact same thing. I didn't want to focus on the negativity of what was going on, but I definitely wanted to pay attention and shine a light on, like, you know what? Yes, we are dealing with difficulties right now. You know, there are difficult days ahead, but I want to be able to go out and dap you and like, yo, we good, fam. It's love. It's all love. No hate, no negativity, no negative energy, no nothing. Milwaukee strong like black coffee, yeah. Milwaukee black and brown, so please change policy, yeah. Milwaukee less work or ended poverty, Milwaukee growing, let's make sure that we grow it properly, yeah. Milwaukee home, so let our love show, Milwaukee special, invest in the home grown. Talent, we all searching for balance, united the good lands, approaching all of our challenges. Every day, in every way, in every way. If we're always conscious and aware of what's happening around us and we're not on autopilot, I think that moving forward, the city will start to really, really demonstrate unity, complete unity. I do. I do.
Sean Hinton is a Milwaukee musician, and he wrote the new song Milwaukee Strong. It features more than 30 local artists. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, a new project in the Portage County area will provide grants for artists to create murals. The project was set up specifically to assist artists pandemic continues to slow the economy and opportunities to create art have dwindled. Greg Wright is the executive director of Create Portage County. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today. Oop, do we have Greg?
I'm here now, yeah.
There you are. Sorry, I think I dropped out for a second. Can you tell us more about this mural project?
Sure. So I work for an organization called Create Portage County. We do creativity-based placemaking and community development work in the Stevens Point area. And we were really watching the economic impact of COVID-19 and how it was affecting the arts. If you've been following that at all, the last data I saw was that it's been more than $10 billion of lost economy for people in the arts sector. And so we were trying to think about what we could do as an organization to help deliver revenue streams to artists that have been impacted at this time. And we have done a couple of mural projects in the past. And we thought that that would be a great opportunity. If we could raise some funds to do some new murals in the community, we could hire artists impacted by COVID-19 to do that work for us.
I know a lot of cities have had mural projects lately. You're trying to get out of kind of the usual suspects, right? Into more rural parts of the area.
Yeah, we see great mural projects happening in Milwaukee right now. We see them happening in Detroit, Chicago, L.A. There are a couple of small towns that have done them. Dubuque actually has a really great mural collection right now. But generally, we see them happening in high-density urban areas. But we think the impact they can have is great. We've done a couple in the city core of Stevens Point as well. But part of the goal of this project is to move that into some of the rural communities around Stevens Point as well.
So can you talk about some of the sites you have in mind so far?
Sure. So we have a call out for a mural in Junction City that is open in terms of its location, but we're still trying to find the right location for that particular project. We're going to do one on the wall of McZee's Brew Pub in Rosholt. We are working on a project called Artists and Fair, which is a rehab of an old Shopko space in the Plover area. And we have a couple of mural calls that are open in terms of location that could happen in Stevens Point or in some of the communities around it, Amherst, Custer, anything in Portage County.
A lot of times we think of art, you go into a place to see it. You go into the museum or a gallery or whatever. Can you talk about the value of having public art, a mural that you could see as you walk or drive by?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of value to public art. One of the biggest things we see is that it's equitable. Access to public art is available to anybody in the community. I know a lot of people don't have time or dollars to go into a museum all the time. A lot of art is purchased and in people's homes. And so if you don't have the resources to buy your own art, it can, you know, really limit people's access that way. Public art, we raise money as a community. We put it in a space that is visible to anybody in the community and it becomes the community's. And so we really appreciate that particular piece of it. The other aspect of it, though, too, is that these public art installations tend to transform community spaces. They attract people who want to not just see them, but interact with them, take, you know, Instagram photos or other social media photos with these pieces of art. And then when they're in that location, they tend to shop. So they visit bars, restaurants, ice cream shops, coffee shops, and they can inject commerce into those areas as well.
We're talking to Greg Wright, executive director of Create Portage County, about a mural project looking to hire artists to create public murals this round in rural parts of central Wisconsin. What's the process here for artists to try to get on board with this, Greg?
So we've set up a web page on our website, createportagecounty.org/paintthecounty, and people can access information about the specific calls there. There also is an application form online there. We're asking for artists to obviously submit the concept they have, submit some examples of their past work. We have some questions as well about economic impact of COVID. If artists can show that they've been impacted in some way, if they have a local connection to the community, we always love working with local artists when we can. We're also using this project to try to increase access to public art space for underrepresented voices in our community. So we're actively looking for artists that are not from the traditional art culture that we have here in Portage County. So, you know, we are open to Polish Catholic artists, but we're also looking for other types of artists as well to participate in this project.
I've seen some comparisons to, you know, a New Deal kind of thinking where, you know, writers and photographers were hired to document the American landscape and people were hired to create art. Is that kind of the spirit of this program?
Yeah, we really took some motivation from some early articles that came out at the beginning of COVID that had talked about the value of a New Deal style investment. We were watching, we're part of an economic recovery team here in Portage County, and we were talking a lot about unemployment and the increase in unemployment. And one thing we were thinking about as an organization is you see all these dollars going to unemployment insurance, which is really valuable at this time, but it's going to really high capacity people who are sitting at home because of this virus. And so we were trying to think about what you could do that would safely activate some of those people who are at home. And the nice part about mural installations specifically is they typically are outdoors. They're typically in a safe location, and they're often done by one person. And so they meet those social distancing requirements for work. So, we wanted to think about what we could do to leverage resources that were available in the state and in our community to activate people who are at home, who are underemployed, who are maybe not able to do their traditional work, and do that in a way that, again, added beauty and culture to our community at a time that otherwise has been really, really hard.
Do you have a timeline in mind for when people in the area could see the painting on the wall?
So we're hoping that some artists will get started yet this late summer and fall. Obviously, we're Stevens Point. It's a snowy community. Once it gets into mid-October, the odds of successfully painting an outdoor mural is pretty low. But we do hope that we'll get at least a mural or three painted before that mid-October deadline. But the project will run through at least next fall. This is actually us kicking off a project we're hoping that we can continue with for a while to see more and more murals come out over time. But specifically, we're looking at trying to do about 10 new murals in the community sometime between now and next fall.
If people want to get more information about this, Greg, whether they're artists or eager members of the public, where can they go to find it?
Again, the easiest place is our website, where they can either go to just our regular homepage, createportagecounty.org, or /paintthecounty. There's information there. We're also actually asking for community members to help us identify locations. So if you're not an artist but have a really great idea of where a mural could go, there's an opportunity for you to send us some information there as well.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Greg Wright is executive director of Create Portage County. He joined us today to talk about a new grant program his organization is starting that aims to employ artists impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic to create murals in rural parts of the area. Coming up, we'll talk about the political mood in Wisconsin's rural counties and the role that farmers are expected to play in the November election. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, college campuses are reopening and some have already opened and closed again to go virtual after COVID-19 outbreaks. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the difficult choices facing campus officials and how students and families are dealing with the changing situation. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Western Wisconsin's rural counties have gotten more political attention in the 4 years since they helped Donald Trump win the state and the presidency, some areas voting Republican for the first time in decades. While the area is now on the map for campaigns, issues like farm closures, trade uncertainty, and a rising number of suicides are still part of the daily reality for people living there. Our next guest spent time talking to farmers in the Driftless area about what it's meant for their lives and their outlook on politics. Dan Kaufman is a contributor to The New Yorker and author of the book The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. He's a Wisconsin native and traveled back there for his latest story. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, as we know, can swing a presidential election, could do it this year, and the part of the state that you focused on here could swing Wisconsin. Talk about how important this is.
Well, I think it's hugely important. The Driftless area, as probably many of your listeners know, has remained largely Democratic long past the time that many other rural places in the U.S. had trended Republican. And it was key to John Kerry's narrow victory in 2004, key to Michael Dukakis's narrow victory in Wisconsin in 1988. And it was also key to Donald Trump's victory in 2016. And it has begun to change. But it also was key to Tony Evers' narrow victory over Scott Walker in 2018. So it's still very much up for grabs. It has a unique history, unique topography, and unique kind of agricultural history that sort of is intertwined with its political history. So I think it's hugely important. Yeah.
That agricultural history is at the heart of the story and of your story. Can you give us a thumbnail view over how agriculture has evolved and changed there and why it's important politically?
Well, I think you've seen a really rapid consolidation of dairy farming, which was sort of the last person standing as far as the survival of the family farm model on a wide scale. And over the past 5 years, milk prices really collapsed in 2015 and have remained low. And that has really put the crunch on smaller farmers who were already under tremendous pressure to get big or get out, in the famous words of Earl Butz, the former Secretary of Agriculture. So this has caused a lot of tension, a lot of pain, a lot of mental health issues, and a kind of erosion of a way of life that has been prevalent there for decades, more than 100 years in some places. So I think it's a profound change, and it has a political effect. You're seeing a lot of rural counties become more and more depopulated, rural schools closing, and so on. And there's a lot of desperation, and sometimes that desperation takes takes form in a kind of resentment towards Madison or towards more successful areas economically. And I think that's kind of what's been happening there. And this consolidation is really, really accelerated. Wisconsin led the country in family farm bankruptcies over the past 3 years, and in 2017 set a statewide record for suicides. So I think all of that is part of the context, the political context that's playing out right now.
Some of the biggest swings I know from counties that voted for Barack Obama to counties that voted to Donald Trump were in this part of Wisconsin. You talked to some farmers there about their thinking going into 2016 and now in 2020. What were some of the things you heard that accounted for candidate Donald Trump's success in the region?
Well, I think there was like a real frustration. One farmer in particular, Jerry Valenit, was somebody that had voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump, not with a great enthusiasm, but he was frustrated at kind of his eroding position. He describes in the piece how, you know, when he started out, he was working less hard 25 years ago and making more money than he is now. Now he says, I'm barely paying myself living expenses. And his grandfather, for example, had a herd of about 16 cows and was able to survive, feed his family, provide for them in the 50s and 60s off of a herd of that size. And Jerry has a herd of 330 and is barely hanging on. So I think there was a lot of frustration that went into that vote. Different people responded differently. Another protagonist in the piece, Randy Roker, also voted for Trump, but had voted for Obama in 2008 and remains committed to Trump. I think Jerry has become enormously frustrated with Trump and swung wildly differently. In fact, he supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. But I think everyone's response is different, but there is a lot of pain and frustration in this area. And I think it will be pivotal to how the state will finally decide, you know, in November.
Talking to Dan Kaufman about his piece in The New Yorker on Driftless Wisconsin, the rural area of Wisconsin that swung from Barack Obama voters to Donald Trump voters, the dairy farming that's a big part of that state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this story in a swing part of the state, of a swing state that could swing the election? Call in at 800-642-1234. Dan, you heard some people rethinking what they want to see when it comes to policy on agriculture, on dairy in particular. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, it runs the gamut. But, you know, actually, interestingly, across the board, the farmers, including both Randy, who supports Trump, and Jerry, who no longer does, they both support what's called supply management, which is what they have in Canada, and essentially what they had during the New Deal period and for the decades after it. Really, the last vestiges were eliminated in the mid-90s. But basically, the government would control more of the production. A big problem for farmers is overproduction of milk is causing prices to be low. And this has been a problem for decades, that the American system of agriculture really encourages people to produce more and more until essentially you almost have kind of the last person standing. And this consolidation in the last 10 years, Wisconsin has lost half of its dairy farms, and yet it's producing more milk than ever. It has roughly the same number of cows. So what you're seeing is bigger and bigger farms and more on the corporate farming model. And that has a real implications for not only the people involved that are going out, but the ecological state of Wisconsin. When you have this concentration, it can really pollute groundwater much more heavily and cause other kinds of ecological problems. And that is happening. You see in Kewaunee County, where a lot of the drinking water is no longer drinkable, a lot of the wells and so on. And this has happened in other places in Wisconsin where there's a dense concentration of dairy farms. And I think that is all part. It's a complex problem that has been going on for decades. And both parties have really kind of encouraged the sort of get big or get out model over the decades.
Another part of that story we've seen here in Wisconsin with dairy, and I know other states have it with their crop of choice. As this concentration happens, it requires fewer people to do it. And we see some of these communities being depopulated. You write about schools closing. Can you talk about the exodus of people from some of these rural communities?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a new report, I think, by Forward Analytics about 2/3 of Wisconsin's rural counties have lost population in the last decade. It has major sociological effects on the people that remain. You're seeing a lot of small businesses in the Driftless, which had kind of endured for a lot longer than in other parts of rural America, partly because of this smaller scale farming that persisted and still does persist to a degree there. It has a lot of organic farms, but it's really coming under pressure. So I think you're seeing these kinds of problems, including mental health problems, suicides. You have to remember, you know, for a farmer, it's not just if their farm goes out, it's not just losing their job. It's also their home. And it might be their home for five generations, or like Jerry's home. You know, I mean, he's still going, but it's a really strong, visceral emotional attachment. And I think a lot of them feel a sense of profound failure, even though they're competing against forces that are far beyond their control if they are the one that loses the farm. So all these things play into it. And this depopulation is having a profound effect on these rural areas and the frustration and the struggles that these people are going through, and also the politics of the area.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jan is with us in Viroqua. Jan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jan?
I just wanted to tell you that you had mentioned that there were a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama and then they switched over to Trump. And I think it's still going on here because I've been driving around the county, Crawford County and Vernon County, all afternoon. And I see about 35, 40 signs that say Trump Pence and 2 signs that say Biden.
Jan, thanks for the call. An informal road survey, Dan. What do you make of that? At least some visible support there for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of support for Trump that endures in these areas. It's always hard to tell from things like signs, but it's not nothing. It does signify something. And one of the farmers I talked to, Randy Roker, he supports Trump still. He also supports supply management, but he and his family are strong Trump supporters. And I think that does endure. I think the question is whether the Democrats will make inroads in the rural areas. I don't think anyone's thinking they will win them. But if they offset the margin, it would probably shift the election, because Donald Trump kind of underperformed in the collar counties of Milwaukee, the WOW counties, which is a traditional Republican stronghold. And what he really offset that with was massive margins in rural Wisconsin. So I think it's really key which way the Driftless goes in particular, because his support is really strong in the Northwoods and in other parts of rural Wisconsin. But in the Driftless, it's more mixed. And you saw Tony Evers won about half of the Driftless counties in 2018 en route to a narrow victory over Scott Walker. So it's really kind of ground zero for Wisconsin, which is the state that's kind of the most pivotal in some ways in the entire country.
We're talking to Dan Kaufman, Wisconsin native and contributor to The New Yorker, about his latest story looking into the political mood in western Wisconsin's rural areas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in agriculture, how has your work, your way of life, affected the way you look at politics? Have you felt overlooked by one party, by both parties? Have you voted for candidates from different parties in different elections? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dan Kaufman, contributor to The New Yorker, about his latest story that brought him back to his home state to look into the political mood in rural western Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you in the Driftless area yourself? Are you a farmer in any part of the state? What are your thoughts on what you've seen from a Trump presidency, on what you see from both parties, either party, when it comes to agriculture and policies related to farming? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I live in Sheboygan County, and I'm a part of a group of progressive women called She Persists, which is based out of Washington County. I'm a progressive voter. We are small hobby farmers, and I'm surrounded by people with Trump signs. I feel a little reluctant to put out a sign, as do many of the women in our group. But there's a bunch of us out there, and I think the number in our group, She Persists, keeps growing. So I just want to be a voice for the progressive women of Washington, Sheboygan counties, and totally support, you know, policies that support our farmers. And it's heartbreaking to see the small farms dwindle away, because it's one of the huge charms of our landscape here in Wisconsin.
Kelly, thanks a lot for that call. So Kelly, seeing herself as a progressive farmer, Dan, with a different model, a smaller scale model of farming. Are there a lot of people out there still like that?
I think there's a growing, there's a lot of young people that are doing that kind of farming. I was at the Wisconsin Farmers Union convention in February, and there were many young couples, young families doing this kind of farming. I think they're struggling to figure out how to make the economics work for them, but I think they're coming up with some creative ideas. And also, just to comment on what she said, I have heard that elsewhere, that some people that are Democrats or Biden supporters are reluctant to put out signs out of fear. So that may be throwing off the perception of you know, the mood in rural areas. But I don't know, but I have heard that anecdotally from a few people.
Kelly, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Peter joins us now in Minnesota. Peter, hi. Peter, are you there? We lost Peter. Peter says, got a note from our producer. Peter says, I'm a dairy farmer in the Driftless part of Minnesota. Peter says they've lost most of their dairy farms since Trump came into office. And Peter makes the case that people are disillusioned with the president. Is that something you've heard? Obviously, Dan, from what you said, not from all farmers. Have you heard that sense of disillusionment that Peter brings up?
Absolutely, yes. I think the trade wars in particular have caused a lot of pain for them. Even farmers, they question the kind of export-driven focus. I think it's had a big impact. And Jerry was a good example of somebody that was not a passionate Trump supporter to start with, but is a passionate kind of anti-Trump voter now. So I think that is true. I think his standing has eroded, and I think he's aware of it. He's given a lot of money to farmers for COVID and also in compensation for the trade wars. Most of that money has gone to the largest farms, however, so it very little of it trickles down. In fact, one farmer told me, a small farmer told me it was about enough money to pay for 2 weeks of feed for his cattle. It was really inconsequential. So I think you're seeing this dynamic play out again. The big farms are the ones that are receiving most of the benefit of the whatever policy the government is implementing.
Let's go to Joyce now with us in Medford. Joyce, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I used to be a dairy farmer for 28 years in Wisconsin, and we had the same struggles as all the other dairy farmers. Things keep getting bigger and bigger. We keep getting smaller and smaller. You know, I'm vacillating between I want to vote for Trump because despite what all the news media says, he actually does have a plan, and it is actually a plan that if it goes through would help us. But on the other hand, I really hate voting for Trump because personally, he's an idiot. I mean, he says things that get people inflamed, and that's not the way I feel personally that I would want to have my government officials do. So I'm torn.
I want to ask which part of President Trump's plans do you see potentially helping dairy farmers like you used to be?
You know, how many years were we trying to tell the government officials that the trade deals definitely threw agriculture under the bus? And so when Trump was trying to renegotiate the trade deals, he was addressing that. He was doing exactly what we in the agriculture field had said we needed him to do.
Got it. Joyce, thank you so much for calling in. And Joyce is not alone in seeing President Trump's kind of hardball tactics on trade ultimately benefiting farmers, Dan.
Yeah, that is a common thread. Randy Roker said something very similar. I would urge listeners to look at the fine print on the renegotiated deal. It's a very NAFTA deal. It's a very, very modest increase in exports allowed into Canada. Roughly $70 million, perhaps less, depending on how you calculate it. But there is a lot of support for his the sense that these trade deals have hurt farmers, and they have. They absolutely have hurt small farmers. There's more than 200,000 fewer small farmers in the United States than before NAFTA was signed. There's been increasing consolidation. A lot of large agribusinesses, like their counterparts in the auto industry, have moved production to Mexico, particularly in the meat industry. So I think the caller is absolutely right that these trade deals have hurt. I don't see the Trump administration's policy as being all that different than what has preceded it. There is a lot of noise around renegotiating them, but the results are not all that different.
Thanks a lot for the call, Joyce. And Dan, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, it was a pleasure, Rob. I'm always happy to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, a stalwart of my childhood. So thanks a lot.
Wonderful. Dan Coffin is a Wisconsin native and a contributor to The New Yorker. Talk about his recent piece on farming and politics in western Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, airlines have been hit hard by the pandemic. We'll find out how they're trying to convince passengers it's okay to fly. That and much more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, plastic pollution has been a long-running issue, and lifestyle changes during the pandemic might be making things worse. Kate and her guests look at plastic waste during COVID-19. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a doctor who says the lack of public data on COVID-19 is standing in the way of the fight to control the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.